Hello?
Yes, Bruce? Oops. Oh, yes, Bruce?
Yes.
Okay. Just one. Are we going to see you?
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how I can get this thing off.
It's going to come through my hand.
Okay, so
there we go. It's the top of my head, and you see my...
Should I turn off the backlight?
How about you? Do I get to see you or no? Oh.
Not yet. Probably not.
Probably not. That's not fair.
Yeah, we've been looking for the camera, but we're like 15 people.
Okay. All right. I don't happen to see you.
No? Okay. If you say so. Attends, just arrêter le screensaver. Just one sec, Bruce. I'm just going to set the thing. Assign it. Was our
what's your contact here?
You the full screen? Just click this here. Ah, view full screen.
We can see you.
Actually, you do need the camera because I need to keep my eye on Ilka.
No worries, his fiance is there.
All right. Then I'm safe, huh?
I'm spying on you, Bruce.
Are we ready? Okay, why don't you go ahead.
Okay. So I had the opportunity in the last meeting to give a class in Houston and also over Skype to some of the Ibero-American locals on the subject of how to make miracles, and I thought I would do the same thing with you guys tonight. I can tell you right off that this is what is necessary to deal with the current strategic situation of the crisis the world faced. We have to not pray for a miracle, but make a miracle. And the first thing you have to know is how to do that. The problem is most people think when they hear you got to make a miracle, they think they should go to church. And I can assure you that's not the place to find out how to make miracles. The first thing you have to do is actually learn to be a physical scientist, because all the great physical scientists like Einstein, Planck, Leibniz, Gauss, Riemann, Plato, they all understood that in effect the physical universe is actually predisposed to produce miracles. It's actually a characteristic of the universe. And this to produce miracles, and this expresses itself in the form of the fact that the universe is characterized by a process which scientists today would call anti-entropic. And that's really what you have to explore. Now, I have proposed and have been writing something on these subjects and discussing it with people, that we science adopt a concept called dynotropy to express the characteristic of anti-entropic potential. And I will explain this to you by actually situating this problem in the context of the directive and the organizing perspective that Lynn has laid out for why we have to colonize the moon and go to Mars. Now, this is a this is something that is not new. LaRouche has talked about this for a long time. It was actually the subject of some of his very early writings back in the 19... hang on one second.
That is tiny.
Okay. It was the subject of his early writings even back in the 1970s, advocating the Mars program. But it became quite famous in the mid-1980s and especially in 1988 as the subject of a half-hour national television broadcast as part of his presidential campaign. And LaRouche specified the requirements of what it would take and the reasons for going to Mars, which really electrified the country and actually was seen all over the world. Now, and it's quite lawful that after all the things that Obama did that were bad, and Lynn's calling out of Obama on April 11th, 2009, in that famous webcast where he identified Obama's narrow complex and what we were facing with the situation with Obama, that after all the things that Obama did, the one that was the final straw, the shutdown of the Constellation program to put a man back on the moon and go to Mars, was the one that LaRouche said tipped the balance from going to a situation where we were saying that Obama deserved impeachment to one in which we said we must impeach Obama. This is a question of national guts right now. That it is unconstitutional and a threat to the nation for the President of the United States to sell out the future of not only the country, but of mankind by destroying a capability which is absolutely necessary for the future development of the human race. Parenthetically, to underscore the importance of why we have to understand the need to make miracles, how to make miracles. I can relate to you a conversation I had with a Tea Party member who came to the January 30th webcast that LaRouche gave. And in that webcast, after the webcast, this guy was, you know, obviously he was anti-Obama, but he was completely provoked by Lynn's insistence that Obama had to be impeached now. And he kept arguing with me, saying, how are you going to do this? I don't like Obama, but I don't see how you can do it. And every argument you made to the guy, he would say, well, that would be nice, but I don't think that can happen. And then finally he said, if you're going to get Obama out, I hope you can do it. If you can succeed, it would be a miracle. And I said to the guy, look, you know, this country's a miracle. The existence of the human race is a miracle, and you have to understand how to make miracles. So I guess the first thing that you got to think about in this regard is, why are we even going to Mars? You know, are we going to Mars and the moon because we need helium-3 and we can bring it back to Earth and, you know, fuel fusion power plants? Are we going to Mars so that we can, because we got too many people on the planet Earth and we need living room? Are we going to Mars so that we can build casinos and just make it a vacation spot? And, you know, obviously those are more absurd things. But nevertheless, most people think about the project of going to Mars in those types of practical terms. Going to Mars will provide a science driver so that we can get jobs here on Earth and help get out of the depression or something like that. When in reality, the reason for going to Mars is to extend man's power in and over the universe. And that's it. That's the end. That's the whole purpose of it. In his 1986-87 discussions of why we're colonizing Mars, LaRouche discussed the actual colony on Mars would be a colony of scientists and technicians whose primary job would be scientific research centered around the placement of a very large array set of electromagnetic detectors that would be sensitive to the entire electromagnetic spectrum, from the long wavelength radio waves all the way up to the through the visible light range and into the X-ray and gamma ray range, and that you would put these detectors into the orbit, into Mars's orbit around the Sun, that is not into orbit around Mars, but in the orbit of Mars, orbiting around the Sun. And if you did this properly, you could actually set up an entire array of devices which would have an effective aperture of as much as 155 million miles, which is roughly the distance of the size of the Mars orbit. And because you were that much further away from the Sun, which is quite noisy and produces a lot of electromagnetic interference, you would be far enough away from the Sun that you could get a much clearer picture deeper into space. Now, are we going to do this so that we can just find out things we already know? Absolutely not. We're doing this because by extending the reach of the human mind that much further into the universe as a whole, we increase man's power in and over the universe in such a way that we enhance our power to, in effect, produce miracles. So when you think of it this way, going to Mars would require a whole series of miracles, impeaching Obama, developing the technology and all the scientific discoveries to be able to solve the problem of colonizing the moon, and also overcoming the problem of relativistic space travel, and then setting up the colony on Mars itself, and then looking deep into the universe to be able to discover principles of the universe. Now, so we don't actually know what's out there, but what we do know is that this project, this endeavor, which we know will take really span 2-3 generations to its full completion, that this endeavor demonstrates a characteristic of the universe that I identified early on, which is that the universe is predisposed to create miracles. That is, you have a demonstrable characteristic of the physical universe itself, that the universe is predisposed to be responsive and to resonate with the creative powers of the human mind. And that this characteristic reflects a principle of the universe which LaRouche calls anti-entropic. Now, one of the most confusing things about the concept of anti-entropy is that people... Two things. First of all, people associate, can't understand a positive idea of something that you define as not being something else. So the term anti-entropy sometimes confuses people, because the first thing is you got to understand what entropy is. And entropy is a false idea. So you're defining the characteristic of the universe as being something which is not something which is false. So that tends to be a little bit confusing to people, but the reason why it's useful to pose it in that way is because the concept of entropy, from its inception in the mid-19th century, has become the central tenet of the official cult religion of the British Empire. And it has become so pervasive in our culture and in our thinking that people believe in it like a cult belief, despite the fact that they may not even know what it's about. So let me take a moment here and explain to you how this concept came about and how it came to infect your mind and the thinking of most of the people whom you talk to. And this has the effect, like an axiom in Euclidean geometry, which Lewis talked a lot about, that if you have a set of axioms and postulates and definitions which people take as things that are self-evident, they cannot be proven but seem to be so true that you don't have to even think about them. Now, in order to really understand, and these are the things which control the way people think, and the concept of entropy is such a concept. And that's why when you say we're going to make a miracle, people look shocked, because they are already thinking about entropy and the concept of entropy, which is associated with something called the second law of thermodynamics, is a concept which people have accepted as an axiom, and it governs their thinking. Now, the issue here, or the general issue here, is that there is an absolute connection and no possibility of separating the way people think society should be organized and the way they think the universe itself works. In other words, the way people think society should be organized reflects the way they think the universe works, and the way they think the universe works always reflects the way they think society should be organized. The typical example of this, or most direct example of this, is the role in all imperial systems, from the ancient Babylonian and Persian empires to the modern one, of scientific concepts or concepts of cosmology which reflect the imperial characteristics of society. And the general principles of the imperial system are that man is not creative, that is, he is not distinguished fundamentally from all other forms of life, that the creative powers of the human mind are accidental and ancillary and have no efficient capacity within the human race, within society, or in the universe as a whole. And therefore, society has to be organized according to a set of principles similar to the way you herd animals and maintain cattle or hunt animals, and that is by maintaining the animals that you herd or hunt in a relatively fixed state of behavior that doesn't change. And it's by maintaining fixed states of behavior, which animals do. Animals have very fixed states of behavior. They're very predictable. You know, the way a dog hunts a rabbit. The rabbit is much faster than the dog, runs back and forth, and does all kinds of things, but it's a very fixed form of behavior. And the dog has a very fixed form of behavior which, in effect, outsmarts the rabbit's behavior. And this is the way all animals are. Cows eat grass, and they can be herded in the same way that they've always been. So they have relatively fixed states of behavior, And the only thing that intervenes to adjust the states of behavior of these of animals is the intervention of the hunter or the herder. And this is the imperial model, that you maintain human beings in a relatively fixed state of societal organization, and the only thing that can possibly come in to adjust the states of behavior is decrees by the emperor, imperial decrees by the emperor. And you see that this is the characteristic of all these empires. In the Babylonian Empire, it was a system of tax farming system, where people were primarily involved in agriculture, and there was a certain amount which had to be paid to the emperor, and so on and so forth. So it was a fixed tax farming system. The Roman Empire, the Persian Empire, you began to have the use of money and monetary instruments to be able to regulate and control and maintain this fixed level of behavior. This got refined in the maritime cult empires, Venice and the so-called Anglo-Dutch Empire. And when you look at the current state of the British Empire, its final phase, what we call globalization, you see that that the use of financial instruments is primarily the main way that the empire maintains fairly successfully up till now, relatively fixed forms of behavior among the peoples on the planet. Now, this is justified by the requirements of maintaining an empire system. And the imperial authorities have always sought the justification of this form of society by by saying that this reflects the actual way the universe works, the physical universe works. And the classic cases I've used many times, but it's important to reiterate, is the Babylonian or Aristotelian cosmology, which holds that the universe as a whole is organized in exactly the way the senses perceive it. You start at the earth, and you go out and you look at the night sky, and you see the earth as being the center of a great sphere, and characteristic of the difference between the center and the circumference is that the closer you get to the center, the more things are material and the more things change. And the further away from the center, the more things become immaterial and they change less and less and less. So you have this fixed state that the philosophy of the imperial system is that in this fixed state, the center is as far away as you can get from the circumference, and the earth, which is everywhere changing, should, according to the imperial powers, be in order to provide a more harmonic characteristic with the non-changing surface of the sphere, is to be imposed an order that doesn't change. And when you look at the history of science, you see that the real fight in the history of science is precisely on this question. Change versus no change. And it comes up in this way, for example, in the thinking about the state of the organization of the physical universe itself, because the argument that the Aristotelians make is that the visible expression of the universe, where you have a very actively changing center and a less changing surface, is that the less things change, the more they become perfect. So that perfection is the furthest away from where things are on Earth. And that perfection is equivalent to a state of no change. But of course, the paradox that was recognized by Plato and many others is that perfection cannot equal no change or limited change, because if something can't change, then there's something it can't do, which is change. And therefore, it is not perfect. And that perfection is actually the principle of self-perfectibility. And this is reflected in the science and in the view of society of both expressed in Plato and in the modern form by the ideas of Kuza, Kepler, and the developments in science and art that followed in the Renaissance. That is, that instead of looking at the changing characteristic of man and nature as being a sign of the imperfection of the world, this is understood as actually the characteristic of its goodness, of its self-perfectibility. And this is expressed in its highest form by the creative powers of the human mind, which, as I said in the beginning, is characterized by the power to be able to create miracles. Because what is a miracle? A miracle is something which exists, which happened, which appears to have been very unlikely, but is totally necessary for the development of the for the solution of the problem. And when you think about how the creative powers of the human mind work, that's the way they work. You have a problem you're faced with, like the current financial crisis, the political and economic problems which we face require something which does not currently exist and must be brought into existence. So the future existence of mankind requires bringing into existence something which seems to be impossible to exist within the current system. That, by definition, is the way a miracle appears. But that's the way the creative powers of the mind work. I point to the classic case of the Meno dialogue, where Meno has a very fixed view of the way the world is. He's a sophist, a wealthy man, an educated man. The slave boy is a slave, supposedly uneducated, stuck in his place. And Plato demonstrates in the dialogue that by Socrates asking the slave boy questions, that the slave boy has the power to make a creative discovery, i.e. the solution of doubling the square. And Plato, by demonstrating that, Socrates shows that the slave boy makes a discovery not only about solving a problem like how to double the square, but he makes a further discovery, which is the discovery of something about himself, about his own creative capacity. And this is how mankind develops, because we make discoveries about principles of science, and we make discoveries about principles of man. And these combination of these two discoveries, which bring into the province of human knowledge concepts which previously didn't exist within the province of human knowledge, which make it possible for man to increase his power in and over the universe to the point where we can go from a few hundred million hunting and gathering individuals to 7 billion people on this planet, which are reaching out to the moon, Mars, and beyond. So that's reflected in the creative powers of the mind. And this expression of the creative powers of the mind reflect the way the physical universe itself works. In fact, as we now know from our astronomical observations, and as Kepler also knew, when you go out and you look at the night sky, what you're the initial impression you get of sense certainty that things are become less changing as you go from the earth is actually false. And as you look deeper and deeper into the heavens, you find all kinds of astronomical phenomena, galaxies, quasars, nebulae, and so on and so forth, huge processes which are generating new forms of organization and existence of matter all the time. That the heavens, rather than being fixed, are actually changing always changing at a greater and greater rate. And they actually express the kind of characteristics that the human mind exhibits in Trade of Discovery. Now, when you look at this, you see that the classic example of this is Kepler, who was a follower of Nicholas of Cusa. And Kepler showed that, contrary to this fixed idea of Ptolemy and Aristotle and the Babylonians, that the characteristic of the planets is that they were everywhere changing. Their motions were everywhere changing. And he did this in a couple ways. One is to prove, and I admit here that I'm being very conclusory and very summary, but I think it's necessary for the argument, and that I would hope that in the discussion afterwards, or I know some people know what I'm talking about, some people probably lost when I talk about Kepler. So, but I would hope that in the discussions afterwards and in the office following this, that everybody can be brought up to speed. But Kepler, the Kepler's primary discoveries are twofold. One is he showed that there is no place in the universe in which you have uniform motion. This is expressed by his discovery that the equant of Ptolemy didn't exist, that the equant was the point of, was a fictitious point which, around which all the planets moved uniformly. That is, when you look at the motions of the planets like Mars and Jupiter and Saturn and Mercury and so forth, these stars have very irregular motions. They speed up and slow down, they make loops and everything else. And the Babylonian philosophy said, well, something that changing can't really exist. So Ptolemy invented a system of circles moving on circles moving on circles, basically epicycles, and that in which these irregular motions could be reduced to a combination of circular uniform motion. And these this circular uniform motion was occurring around a point at which everything appeared to be moving uniformly. That's the point he called the equant. Equant means point of equal motion. And what Kepler showed was that such a point did not exist, that the planets were everywhere moving, and that the characteristic of the universe was that it was actually everywhere changing. And that, but even deeper, Kepler, being a follower of Cusa, came to this conclusion and understood this conclusion as being consistent with his concept of the nature of man. That is, it's the creative powers of mankind, the power to change the way you think, the power to make a creative discovery, the power to completely revolutionize your own thought and your own thinking about man and nature, which is reflected in the universe as a whole, that this is the goodness of man, and it's reflected in the universe as a whole. And so Kepler said that God would not have constructed the universe according to principles that man would not be able to discover. And that is, the physical universe itself must conform to the characteristic of the creative powers of the human mind. This was Kepler's conviction. And therefore, he sought in the physical universe to discover those principles, and lo and behold, he discovered that not only are the planets everywhere changing, but that they're changing in such a way that the principle by which they're changing conforms to the way in which the creative powers of the human mind function. And specifically, this was reflected in his Harmonies of the World, where he showed that the harmonic relations between the motions of the planets are the same harmonic relations that human beings use in polyphonic music to convey ideas about how the mind works. And Kepler's discovery of this was later put into further development in the domain of art by Johann Sebastian Bach, and the revolution that Bach established was advanced in particular by Mozart, Beethoven, and their collaborators and followers. So this is Kepler's discovery and Kuznets' discovery, not coincidentally, but causally, were part of an effort to overthrow the empire system once and for all, and to establish a form of government and society consistent with this view of science. And that was the Republican form of nation-state committed to the common good. Now, at first, they tried to establish such a Republican form of government that was based on the consent of the governed. And they initially tried to establish this in Europe, on the European continent, and they succeeded in a limited degree in the nation-state of Louis XI in France, and also in Henry VII's England. But the problem was is that this was done with difficulty because of the entrenched power in the European continent of the empire, the imperial oligarchy, which involved the Habsburgs, involved the British oligarchy, involved the French oligarchy, and the Italian oligarchy, the German oligarchy, the Spanish oligarchy, all these feudal lords and noblemen and so forth had so much power that any attempt to establish a nation state was thwarted. And so Kuza recognized that this, in order for this to really work, they had to get away from Europe and get into the New World. And so he had a friend named Toscanelli who had a map, and Toscanelli got his map to a Genoese sea captain named Columbus, who was able to persuade the king and queen of Spain, who were not very good people, to finance his voyage. They had, the oligarchy had their motivations, Columbus had other motivations. And this led to a wave of colonization. The most positive parts were the French colonization in Quebec by Colbert and the English colonization of the New England area, especially the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which were coordinated with Kepler's and Kuza's primary scientific follower, Gottfried Leibniz. And Leibniz took Kepler's science and extended it even further under what we call the science of dynamics. The word he used, dynamics, comes from the Greek word dunamis, which basically means principles. And Leibniz's idea of dynamics was that the physical universe reflects the way in which the creative powers of the human mind work, and this is summarized by his concept of the principle of sufficient reason, that nothing happens in the universe without a sufficient reason. And he addressed this question on many levels, politics, in his writings about the nature of man and the nature of society, and also in the domain of physics, in his criticisms of René Descartes, who had a mechanistic view, a fixed view of the universe. And one of the principles of the principle of sufficient reason, one of the corollaries of it, in effect, is Leibniz's idea of the principle of least action. This was a follow-on of Fermat's theory of how light travels in the period of least time. In broadest terms, Leibniz's idea was that nothing can happen in the universe that is unreasonable. That every effect must be the complete effect of the full cause. And from this argument, he argued that for this reason, it would be impossible in the physical universe to have a perpetual motion machine. You could not have perpetual motion because perpetual motion means that you would have motion created which did not have a cause. And that would mean something irrational happened in the universe. And if something irrational happens, then the universe is not susceptible to being brought under the dominion of the human mind. Therefore, perpetual motion can't exist. Now, the paradox is, if perpetual motion can't exist, how do you get a higher form of development? And Leibniz's answer was, in the same way you get new ideas. A new discovery, by its very nature, is something that doesn't exist. Whether it's a revolutionary discovery that's totally original to mankind, or whether it's a rediscovery which is original to the person who's making the discovery, like the slave boy in the Meno dialogue. And so the mind is capable of generating something new from within it. It doesn't come from without, it comes from within the mind, but it's something which only existed as a potential prior to its discovery. And this is what Leibniz understood how the mind worked, and he said this is the way the universe works, the physical universe works, and the example he gave was the example of physical action, that it was the that you had in physical action a power which he called vis viva, which was what actually caused the motion. And this was proportional in physical action to the mass of an object times the square of the velocity. And this was distinguished from what Descartes' theory was that the motion of an object was determined simply by the mass and the velocity. Now, a quick example to show you how this works is that in life, if you have a pendulum swinging, you lift the pendulum up to a certain height and you let it go, the pendulum accelerates down and reaches a minimum height. And when it reaches the minimum height, it has its maximum motion. And that power that it has assumed in its trajectory downward enables it to move to a higher position. But the higher position cannot be higher than the initial position in which it started, because then you would have perpetual motion. And the effect, and he showed that this was proportional, this motion, this power was proportional to the mass times velocity squared. And this is very easy to understand if you just compare in your own mind the following thought experiment. What would be the power of a 1 pound or 2,000 pound car traveling at 1 mile an hour, it wouldn't have very much power. If it hit you, you wouldn't be hurt. But if a 1 pound cannonball travels 1,000 miles an hour, the power of that would kill you. So you can see the difference. And the difference is that the power is proportional to the square of the velocity, not the velocity. Now the significance of this is it means that if you can impart a high velocity to something with very small mass, which is easier than imparting a low velocity to something with a large mass, but a high velocity with something which is small mass gets you a huge amount of power. And the because of this discovery, you had the development of a new revolution in technology, the heat-powered machine. Now, prior to the end of the 17th, early 18th century, when Leibniz lived, man's use of heat was primarily in the form of light and cooking and heating the space. That power that was directed toward producing work, changes in the physical universe, was either gravity power in the form of a water wheel, wind power in the form of a windmill, or muscle power, either human or animal. But heat was not a power source until Leibniz. And this gave us the ability to accelerate small particles of water in the form of steam to very high velocities, and that would deliver a huge amount of power. And this opened up a whole new domain of science to actually discover what is the nature of this power that we can generate with heat. Now, the interesting thing is that, and on first approximation, heat appears to behave like gravitational power. Because if you think about how a pendulum works or how a water wheel works, it works by having something flow or move from a high gravitational potential to a lower gravitational potential. Like the water flows onto the wheel and it falls down, so the power of gravity is pulling the water down, and that turns the wheel, the mill, and everything else. And it appears that heat conforms to that, because with heat, the heat flows from a hot reservoir to a cooler one, and that's what produces the work. But here's the paradox. In the case of gravity, the water can flows from a high potential to a lower potential, but the water can also flow from a lower potential to a higher one. A pendulum can swing from a high gravitational potential to a low one, but the power it generates will swing it back up to a higher potential. Right? However, with heat, it seems to be different, because whereas heat flows from the hot to the cold, heat cannot flow from the cold to the hot. So whereas gravitational power appears to be reversible, heat power appears to be irreversible. It's this irreversibility of the heat power which poses an apparent paradox. Because when you have heat flowing from a hot reservoir to a cold reservoir, the net result is a state of what's called thermodynamic equilibrium, where the heat is evened out. Like if you take a hot piece of iron and put it in a cold bath of water, the iron gets cooler, the water gets warmer, and you end up with an equilibrium in which the temperature of the iron and the water are equal. What doesn't happen when you put a hot piece of iron into a cold bath of water is that the iron gets hotter and the water gets colder. Now, the question is why? Why with heat does it only go in one direction? Well, this is something that scientists were trying to figure out. But mostly what they were what the main work that was being done with heat and heat-powered machines was to try and figure out how it was that what was the most efficient way to make a machine, to maximize the power. And this was primarily the work of Sadi Carnot and Lazare Carnot. Now, they were looking at this investigation of heat, and because of this discovery that Carnot made, Sadi Carnot in particular, which is known as the Carnot cycle, it demonstrated the maximum way in which you could maximize the power of heat. So that's the way people were looking at this question of heat development. And into this paradox stepped a couple of real venal jerks who, at the service of the British Empire, used this paradox to try and reintroduce this imperial doctrine that was the same as Ptolemy, the Aristotle, the Babylonian priests, of the idea that the universe prefers a state of no change to a state of change. Because when you get to a state of equilibrium, you've reached a state of no change. You can't, once you get to equilibrium, you can't get more equilibrium. Once the iron and the water reach the same temperature, that's the end. Nothing more will happen. That nothing gets, it can't go any more, get any more equal. So the first jerk of significance who monkeyed around with this on behalf of the British Empire was a guy named William Thompson. He was a Scotsman who was very much involved, very active in the Presbyterian Calvinist theology. He was an engineer who was doing work in electricity and thermodynamics and machines and so forth, not an unskilled engineer or so forth. But he ventured into the domain of the mysterious and wrote a series of papers about what he called the tendency for the dissipation of heat in the universe. And he took this example of heat tending towards equilibrium and said that this was the way in which heat, this was a characteristic of the universe as a whole. That everything in the universe depends on heat, and that since heat tends towards equilibrium, all things, including non-living things, living things, and human beings, will ultimately tend towards equilibrium. And therefore, the universe would come to a point at which all motion would stop. And he called this ultimate heat death of the universe, which he is obviously a very pessimistic view. But he said that people should not be too overly pessimistic about this, because if this heat death of the universe would not actually occur, because a creative force from outside the universe would intervene to prevent it from happening. This is very similar to the idea of an imperial decree, that everything in the universe tends towards a fixed state, and if anything is going to change that fixed state, it's the decree of the emperor, a creative force outside the universe. And for this work, Queen Victoria knighted William Thompson and made him Sir William Thompson. And because he continued to perpetuate this false doctrine, he was eventually named a baron, and he took the title of First Baron Kelvin of Largs, and so he's known today as Lord Kelvin. You might know his name that way, not as William Thompson. So, so he did this work in 1852. Now, it was kind of shoddy, as you could tell. And so the British needed more, to put more precision to it. So a young German named Rudolf Clausius took up this same project from the standpoint of reviewing the work that Sadi Carnot had done on the nature of heat-powered machines. And Clausius looked at this question of the heat-powered machine and did two things. First of all, he took Leibniz's idea of power. That is, what you have is a power to move an object, which is an immaterial power. He called it a metaphysical principle. And that this metaphysical principle was completely responsible for the motion, the full motion. And this got it reintroduced into an idea from power to this Aristotelian idea of energy. That energy was something that was intrinsic to the body, and so into the matter. And so you had these two types of energy, kinetic energy and potential energy, and that what was happening in the motion of a pendulum or something else was a transformation of energy into potential and kinetic and back again, and that the total amount of energy was constant. So Clausius writes this long book about heat-powered machines and the concept of energy, and he ends it with a statement, a two-part statement. The first part is that the energy of the universe is constant. Now, there's a problem with respect to heat. I mean, this idea of the pendulum, you can see you've got the potential, the kinetic, and the potential, and these things are converted back to each other. But with heat, if you take my example of the hot iron going into the cold water, If the iron were to go the opposite way, that is, the iron were to get hotter and the water colder, you would still have a conservation of energy. You would not have any new energy created. You would be taking energy from the cool water to make the iron hotter, and the water and the absence of the energy would make the water cooler. But if you could do that, you could then take that extra heat and put it back into the water, and you would have a type of perpetual motion. So he said this would cause perpetual motion of the second kind. So he said we've got to deal with this paradox by inventing a new word, a new concept, which he called entropy. And he invented that word. He wanted it to sound like energy. And he took it from the Greek word tropei, which means to change, and the prefix en, which means internal, so internal change. And he wanted that to sound like energy. So he called it entropy. And the entropy is the expression of how something is changing. So the greater potential for change, the lower the entropy. The less the potential for change, the greater the entropy. This is Clausius' idea. So if you have a piece of hot iron and cold water, and you put the two together, you're starting with something of low entropy, which has a great potential for change. And as the iron gets cooler and the water gets hotter, you're decreasing the potential for change as you get closer and closer to equilibrium, and you're increasing the entropy. So the second part of Clausius's doctrine that he ends his book with, the first is the energy of the universe is constant, and the second is that the entropy of the universe tends towards a maximum. So based on this simple phenomenon of heat, Clausius introduces what I said becomes the central tenet of the official cult religion of the British Empire. That the universe as a whole is fixed, and that the characteristic tendency of the universe is from states of great potential for change to states of lower potential for change. And this becomes the basis on which you justify the organization of society, to try and fix society in such a way that you try and get as close to equilibrium as possible. And this is the whole basis on which modern economics is evolved. This is what globalization is about. This is what derivatives trading is about. You take the, you try to minimize the risk by spreading it out. Now, the ironic situation is that the effort to try and produce a society that is in a state of equilibrium or maximum entropy or minimum potential for change has produced the current crisis, which is a potential for great change, either for good or for ill. So the universe itself is showing that it doesn't have anything to do with equilibrium. Now, this was, this, as I said, 1850, 1860 was the period where Clausius and Kelvin introduced their doctrine. And it really was not accepted by scientists or philosophers because you still had the influence of Gauss and Riemann. And then you had, and we don't have time tonight to go into the details of this, but the further study of heat took science into the domain of looking at universal characteristics in the relationship between heat and light. Because you have a strange relationship between heat and light. When you heat an object, it emits light, and when light falls on an object, it gets warm. You go out even on a cold day, and you feel the sun feels warm. Where's the heat? So the interaction between light and a material substance, or radiant heat and the material substance, leads us into a very interesting relationship about the nature of heat. That it's not what Clausius and Kelvin described it as. A classic example is if you take a piece of ice and you fashion a magnifying glass out of that ice, you can focus the sun's rays with that ice lens on a piece of paper such that it could burn the paper but not melt the ice. So where's the heat? What's the interaction with the heat and light? And this I don't have time to go into, but it involves the studies of the interrelationship between heat and light that led Kirchhoff to design this concept of what's called black body radiation, which is where you set up an experimental apparatus which produces a state of thermodynamic equilibrium involving heat and light. And in 1900, Max Planck discovered that in order for such a black body radiation system to get into a state of equilibrium, it could only be occurring if something very nonlinear were happening in the microscopic domain. That is what has since become known as quantized effects. And Einstein later also expanded on Planck's work. And this became known as Einstein's theory of light quanta, which is what led to the term today that people use called photons. And this has all kinds of interesting implications about light being a particle or a wave, which, as I say, tonight we don't have time to fully get into this. But the basic principle here is that what Einstein and Planck showed in 1900, 1905, was that this simplistic, pessimistic view of Clausius of the universality of entropy, of the so-called second law of thermodynamics, could not be the essential characteristic of the physical universe. But they did this work at a time of great transformation, in which the success of Lincoln in 1860 over the British in the Civil War had been countered, had led to the spread of the American system, but the British reacted with, between the firing of Bismarck, the launching of the Russo-Japanese War, the launching of the Japanese invasion of Korea and China, and which was leading ultimately in the early decades of the 20th century to what became World War I, that this tendency tended to try and reestablish the primacy of the second law of thermodynamics as a scientific principle, and it found its expression in atomic physics in something known as the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, which some people are familiar with the name. What you're most familiar with is an aspect of that called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which attempts to state that the universe is fundamentally random, and that any order or organization that we see in the universe is an accident occurring against the backdrop of a universe which is fundamentally random. And randomness is like thermodynamic equilibrium. Once you achieve randomness, you can't get more random. You've maximized the entropy by maximizing the randomness. And this is the way people think, that the universe is basically nothing but random action, and anything positive that happens, any organization, is something which happens against the natural tendency of the universe to try and become more random, i.e. Kelvin's idea of the dissipation of heat. And it's this false belief which people carry around in them which causes them to say stupid things and believe stupid things, which keep them enslaved to the British Empire. Say things like, you'll never change things. Things have always been that way. Whatever good you do will be countered by bad. You're never going to be able to impeach Obama. It will be a miracle if you do so. LaRouche's idea will work, but the empire will always be here. You'll never get it done. Man is basically evil, and so on and so on and so forth. So all these stupid things that people say are really just their crude expressions of this false idea that was introduced by two frauds, Kelvin and Clausius, in the middle of the 19th century, known as the second law of thermodynamics. And they believe that the universe is essentially entropic. So therefore, what you have to understand if we're going to be able to deal with the physical, with the political and social crisis mankind faces, if we're going to be able to colonize Mars and so forth, we have to purge mankind from this false belief of universality of entropy and understand that the universe is characterized by anti-entropic potential. As I said, I've suggested we use the term dynotropic potential instead of internal change, dynamic change. Change from lower states to higher states of organization existence, which is actually the way society and physics are characterized. And that's, and I'll be elaborating that in things that I'm writing and talking about and so forth. But Lynn has already really elaborated the concept already, so it's already there. I'm just proposing a name for it. In any case, I think I've given you some things to chew on, and you can Now, throw questions at me from angles that I can't see.
Hey, Bruce?
Yeah.
Hi, it's Matthew.
Hey, Matthew. How you doing?
Good, good. I had a quick question, just and something you didn't quite touch on, but it's been on my mind since it came up in a briefing, just in regards to something that Sky had said during one of his interviews regarding the human genome having been, you know, discovered completely, or we figured out what the human genome is, and that it's mostly made of viruses. And the second part, I want to know, like, if you knew anything more about that. And he also mentioned that there's certain evidence that shows that viruses in general would be activated and deactivated due to different forms of cosmic and nuclear radiation coming in from deep space. And I was wondering if you could just elaborate on that. I didn't know anything about this.
Well, I don't know about the genes being made of viruses. I mean, basically, viruses are little pieces of DNA. And so I guess you could say genes are viruses, but you could also say viruses are genes. And yes, there is a very poorly understood concept or interrelation between genes and between the effect of cosmic radiation on these genes, but there's also an effect of magnetism, electricity, gravity, and so forth and light, which are very poorly understood. So this is a whole area which I think the current state of our knowledge is extremely limited, especially because the characteristic or the way it's understood is in this very mechanistic way, that the genes are a series of codes, basically, of four different amino acids. And that these amino acids, you know, are put together in different combinations, forming these long strings, sort of like the way ones and zeros form all the strings on a computer. And all the code, ultimately all the code, the image of me, my voice, everything else, has been translated into ones and zeros and then recoded. And it's trying to look at the genes as a similar type of thing, that you just have different combinations. Instead of two things, you have four. And that there's some interaction or transformation of these combinations by cosmic and radiation. But the field is very, very poorly understood. And one of the things Lynn has tasked the basement with doing right now is to actually study the cosmic radiation. And actually, you know, develop some ideas about it.
It's kind of a silly question. Hi, Bruce.
Yeah.
Hi, Meredith here.
Hi, Meredith.
Yeah, this is kind of maybe a bit of a banal question, but when you were describing, when you got to the point of describing the way that sort of a water and a pendulum act differently, actually, than heat, you were talking about, I can understand how the pendulum can go back up, but I was wondering if you could describe how the water can go back up. Does that not require heat to get it back up there?
No, you can get. Well, that's what an Archimedean screw does. You know the famous Archimedean screws that the Archimedes invented and used for water wheels, water wells. Or you can, if you have water, imagine like a Ferris wheel type of water wheel, which has these little cups, which collect the water as it goes down, and the weight of the water moves the wheel down, and then the buckets turn around and pick water up, so that the water flowing down from the top is lifting the water, is also lifting water up from the bottom.
Oh, yeah.
Water can be made to flow uphill. You have to do something to it to make it flow uphill, but it can. But heat, you know, you're not going to get the heat out of the cold, out of the water into the hot iron.
Right.
So that's the difference. So then the paradox becomes, well, how do you get new states of organization? And that's the point. That the fallacy is that this simple example of heat in this limited sense is not a universal principle. But Clausius states it as a universal principle without any proof. And when you look at the universe, you see it does exactly the opposite. Now you get idiots who say all kinds of crazy things like, well, you know, you have life, which is takes heat and turns it into more organized things, but that's happening at the decrease of temperature of the sun and, you know, the star. But how does anybody know that? You know, how do you, if you look at the solar system, you look at the galaxies, you see that actually the characteristic of the universe is highly organized. You don't have things dissipating into a state of equilibrium. They're actually becoming more organized. There was a conference at MIT in 2007 called Meeting the Entropy Challenge. And it had all these scientists there trying to explain how you can continue to accept the second law of thermodynamics when, you know, modern biology, cosmology, and even quantum mechanics contradict it. It's pretty funny to see these guys flop around and try and justify something. But that's what they do.
What year was that conference?
2007. They actually have videos of the thing up on the website. So if you go to, if you Google MIT Meeting the Entropy Challenge 2007, you'll probably find it. And you can watch some of these speeches of these guys trying to claim that they preserved the second law of thermodynamics. Some of the talks are technical, but they're quite hilarious, at least as far as I could see.
Bruce, I have a question. You know, Lynn addressed this issue of misunderstanding in the organization of the triple curve. I had some discussion with, you know, in Leesburg recently, but the thing is, I still don't understand the dynamic relationship between the three curves. One of the problems is we're having more or less a statistical, static, you know, interrelation between the, you know, in the understanding of this curve, and a lot of misunderstanding with the nature of the crisis is a financial crisis. I would ask you if you can elaborate a little bit, you know, what Lynn think about the triple curve and what is the problem in our understanding of it.
Well, I think the thing that Lynn was mostly concerned with there is that people were intending to interpret all three curves as, and especially the monetary and the financial curve, as monetary aggregates. And they're not. And so if you think about it in terms of money, then there's really no difference between the second and the third curve, between the financial curve and the monetary curve.
What is the difference?
Well, he elaborated that with his financial, with the healthy economy, you have two curves. The financial curve is credit. Credit is not money. Credit is the investment You might use money to organize it, but as a medium of exchange. But credit is the investment of the current resources of society towards the future. Like, you know, an example I think is illustrative, is not one that Lynn gave, but one that I think is illustrative, is think about education. Not in terms of money, but in terms of, you know, deploying people, resources, and the physical goods, the physical resources of society necessary to maintain the households of those involved in an educational system, teachers, administrators, and also the people involved in the construction and manufacturing of the buildings and equipment and everything else. So you're investing a large amount of society's resources in the development of the potential for the future productivity of society. So it's a form of credit. You might use money to facilitate it, but it's not. The money doesn't make the educational system. You're investing a credit of the existing surplus of society. You're producing enough of a surplus in your existing economy to invest that surplus in the development of something future. Infrastructure is a similar thing. You're investing the surplus of your existing productive capacity to construct a power plant or a water project or something like that, which will have a investment or a productive capacity, improve your productive capacity over a period of 50 years, one, two generations. So that's the way you got to think about it. The financial curve is the credit. And the monetary curve is the money assets. Now, in the imperial system, the monetary curve tends to pollute the financial assets, aggregates, and in 2007, or you had a crossover at a certain point, and then the crossover led to a collapse. And the financial aggregates have ceased to exist, and all you have is monetary aggregates. And as Lynn said yesterday, the monetary aggregates are not assets. The assets that everybody's holding is somebody else's money. It's the people who they say which those people don't have. So the problem here, the conceptual problem, is people thinking about the relationship of the three. First of all, the three curves are one system, the three aspects of a single process. And the curves, you know, the interconnectedness is a single interconnectedness. And the biggest problem there is the money. And the problem people have is you interpret financial instruments and physical production from the standpoint of money as opposed to from the standpoint of physical economy. And then the money becomes simply a vehicle by which you efficiently can allocate and organize the assets, the productive capacity.
Hello, Bruce.
Yeah.
So there's a question, I guess it's in two parts, but the person was asking, what is heat? Basically, how heat came about, or what is it made of, or I guess more how it came about at the beginning. Please, thanks.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think the actual answer is, what is heat? The answer is, who knows? A lot of people tell you different things. The idea of heat. You know, what is gravity? What is electricity? What is magnetism? These are terms which people throw around a lot. you know, an early hypothesis was that heat was a fluid, and a fluid that existed in all bodies and could flow in and out of bodies without any resistance. And the name that they gave of this fluid was caloric. But certain things like the heat generated by friction and grinding metals and so forth indicate that this idea is not very tenable. So, you know, one thought that what replaced that is that heat was the motions of molecules. Now, this was originally put forward. Carnot actually originally had the caloric theory of heat, but he hypothesized this idea of heat being the motion of molecules. Clausius accepted that. Ludwig Boltzmann was the main guy who advocated this. And this was all before the existence of molecules had ever been demonstrated. And so Clausius, so that's another theory. But that theory tends to break down when you deal with things like what I was discussing before about the relationship between heat and light. And therefore, you know, that makes it even more murky. So, and this was something that you know really is sort of the main subject of science. Riemann, in his fragments, talks about looking for a theory to unify heat, light, gravity, magnetism, and electricity. And I think that's still where science really is. We've sort of lost an entire century. Where we've made certain experimental progress, but we've made very little theoretical progress towards such an end. That's what Einstein really dedicated the last 30 years of his life to, trying to develop a unified concept of heat, light, gravity, and magnetism.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
Yeah, quick question for you. You've been telling us about the colonization of Mars. I'd like to know if there are other great nations currently that are looking at the same project. And we know Russia has a lot of space advancement. I'd like to know if there's any nations that are looking towards this project here, and how much they're involved in making it happen.
Well, first thing to remember is that when the United States landed a man on the moon in July of 1969, 3/4 of the world's population watched that. It's really quite amazing. And this was something which was seen not as an accomplishment by an American, but that it was an American as a representative of all mankind. Mm-hmm. The first words were, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. And nobody thought about it, including the Americans. There may have been a certain element of the space race and the Cold War, and we wanted to beat the Russians. But I can tell you, from somebody who lived through that, grew up during that period, that I think that was really minimal. Most people, including Americans, saw that as a great achievement for mankind as a whole. And the crime was that the United States dropped that leadership shortly after. Really, we dropped it before. It was too hard to stop it in the process. And so by dropping that leadership, because in 1969, the year that man landed on the moon, the NASA budget was organized to produce a permanent colony on the moon and a manned mission to Mars by 1985. So, by dropping the, at the insistence of the British Empire, by the United States dropping the commitment, it pretty much set back not only the United States, but all mankind in that endeavor. Because we weren't organizing and taking the leadership that would have allowed the other countries of the world who would have an interest in it to participate. Now, LaRouche, since he's been advocating this for a long time, he has engendered a certain amount of interest in this in Russia, in China, in India, all three of which have, especially China and India, have programs to send a man to the moon. Other countries like South Korea, Indonesia, Brazil have active space exploration efforts. And then, of course, you have the European nations, the European Space Agency, and Canada as well. So I would think that if we were to have this kind of commitment on the part of the United States again, that you would get very active and substantial participation from virtually every nation on Earth, with Russia, China, India, South Korea, Indonesia, Brazil, Canada, the European nations, Japan, being pretty much, you know, initially providing the biggest bulk. But just initially, I think every country would ultimately participate in it. And but it has to be led by the United States, because there is no other nation on the planet which is really capable of organizing that international leadership. And if you don't have that international cooperation, it's not going to happen. But if the United States were to initiate that, if Obama were to be impeached, when Obama's impeached and the new administration comes in and announces it, you're going to see a lot of people knocking on our door saying, let's get together.
Yeah, hey, Bruce.
Yeah.
I have another question in regards to the moon. And I was reading in the writings of Da Vinci how he was wondering how the moon doesn't fall towards the Earth, since he assumes that, you know, and rightly so, that it's a solid mass and things fall to the Earth, but this thing doesn't. And it's something I sort of took for granted. I was like, oh, that's a silly question. It's the moon. That's why it doesn't fall. But then the more I thought about it, it kind of got a little confusing to me. And I was recently listening to a class by Larry Hecht that he recently gave on the moon model, and he brought up something regarding magnetism, because we were discussing gravity, but then he brought this issue of magnetism up, where if you bring two, or when you look into a nucleus and you have two, like, protons together inside of the nucleus of a small atom, they don't repel each other as you would think that two like charges really would, because, well, there's some weird effect happening that brings them, that allows them to coincide and live together in the orbit inside of it. And I was wondering if that process explains at all why the moon doesn't fall into the Earth, but stays around it. I don't know, it's kind of a befuddled question, but
well,
I don't have any insight.
Well, no, because you're describing two different phenomena, and this is what Einstein was really trying to resolve. You can't explain the strong nuclear force which holds the protons together by some aspect of gravity, and you can't explain the other. The force that holds the protons together is much stronger. One of the great paradoxes of modern time of physics right now to this day is why is gravity such a weak force compared to electricity, magnetism, and the strong or weak nuclear forces. So this is what Einstein was really trying to struggle with. Our current understanding of them show these as two different things. But they're not two different things. there are two different aspects of a higher principle, and we don't know what that higher principle is yet. And that's what we have to discover.
Does Christian Huygens' centrifugal...
Get closer to the mic, I can't hear you.
Does Christian Huygens' centrifugal force discovery shed any light on that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, Huygens was trying to work with this idea, and, you know, Leibniz then helped him with it. And then Newton basically screwed everything up with his idea of force. So Huygens is a superior idea, but no, the real solution to that question is Kepler's idea of universal gravitation.
Bruce, if you don't mind, I'd like to take the question back to this idea of back to the economics thing that Ilko started there. And what was it about LaRouche's forecast that he made in 1956? What's the crux of that forecast? And just struggling with, because you have this idea of, to me there has to be some idea of value involved, because he understood that the values that were being put on the books were fraudulent values, and that the thing was going to crash. I was wondering if you could just explain in your own words what you think of that forecast. Try and shed some understanding on that.
Well, I think the problem you have thinking about it is the one that Lynn keeps identifying, which is people are really stuck in thinking in terms of things monetarily, in terms of money values. And Lynn's economics come from an understanding that he has already back in his early work from Leibniz, and then his work in his refutations in the late 40s of Wiener and Shannon and von Neumann on the question of physical economy. Lynn was a physical economist, and he earlier he recognized, and I think he was also partly influenced in this regard by Roosevelt, the fact that what Roosevelt did in the with his programs was to focus on building up the physical economy. What Roosevelt was concerned about was not money, but he was concerned about employing people in forms of employment, which productive employment, which produced an increase in the physical potential of the productive capacity of the nation. So when you look at things like the TVA, the Bonneville Power, the Hoover Dam, the all these various infrastructure programs, that's what made it possible for the country to basically become the arsenal of democracy in World War II. And what Lynn saw at the end of World War II was two things. One was a cultural shift that he's described a lot, that you had among the returning veterans in the late 40s. Who had participated in this great development in World War II and in the Roosevelt Reconstruction, and had since become demoralized and pessimistic and less committed to productive employment. And you had the growth of the so-called white-collar employment, where the idea of being a productive worker became diminished, and you had a growth of white-collar employment, people who would, you know, have jobs that did not involve actually producing anything. So we saw that cultural change. And then you had this huge productive capacity that had been built up for the war machine. And Roosevelt's intention had been, as he described it during the war, that this huge capacity, which would no longer be needed for military production, could be reconverted, because it had been converted from civil production into military production under the War Production Board, could be reconverted back to civil production, but not simply for domestic use, but for developing the infrastructure and productive capacities of what Roosevelt assumed would be, or would insisted would be, the newly freed colonies from the French, British, Portuguese, Spanish, Dutch empires. And that didn't happen because Truman came in there and the United States went on the side of the British and we had the Cold War, and those countries did not become independent until the mid-60s. You still maintain the colonial system. They were not allowed their independence until the IMF and World Bank system had been so thoroughly corrupted that the independence of these countries would be just a pseudo-independence and not a real physical independence. So in the absence of that output for the in the absence of that outlet for the this massive industrial capacity, in the early 1950s you began to have a substitute for that in terms of this trying to use the automobile sector as the driver for the rest of the industrial production. As a lot of industrial production was taken down, you put a lot of your workforce into these unproductive white-collar jobs, and then you would use the automobile sector as the basis to push this the productive capacity, because the automobile would then become, you know, the end run for steel and glass and rubber and plastics and all the things that went into a car. So therefore you had to figure out a way to get people to buy more cars, which, you know, you had a shift in the idea of an automobile from a machine which had a useful purpose, in which case it should be designed like the Model T Ford or something, to be cheap, affordable, and functional, and last until it could break. And instead you had a shift where the automobiles were designed to break down after 2 years, and there, why would anybody buy such an expensive piece of machinery that's going to wear out in 2 years? Well, you give a loan to do it, and then the only thing people care about is not how much the car costs, but whether or not they can afford the monthly payment. And all they have to do is be able to afford the monthly payment, and at the end of 2 years, they trade it in for something else. And that's where you built up this bubble, which by today's standards was minuscule. But in the 1950s, this was quite a large bubble, and so a lot of the economy depended on it. And Lynn said this bubble is going to break because it's all based on a phony monetarist policy, and sure enough, it did. And like today, it caused a severe recession, which affected not just automobile workers, but people all over the throughout the economy.
Yeah, Bruce.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a question about thermonuclear fusion. In the past couple of weeks, they made like a breakthrough in some laboratory in the States. I remember like 2 weeks ago. They were able to get like more energy out of a fusion reaction than what they put in. I don't know the specifics of it, but my question is that I happen to be reading an encyclopedia of technology and inventions that my friend had. It's a pretty old one. And it said in it that people have actually been doing fusion for a while now. Like, they said the H-bomb was basically fusion, but it was uncontrolled. Now, my question is, like, if they can do it as an H-bomb, how come they can't control it and harness the energy from it?
Well, they could. You can harness the energy from H-bombs. That was actually an idea that they were working with in the 1950s, was to detonate H-bombs deep under the earth and use that to power steam turbines. And one H-bomb would then be able to produce enough power to run turbines for a long time. So you actually can harness the power of an H-bomb. But the basic principle of fusion is that you have a light nuclei of deuterium, which is hydrogen with an extra proton, or maybe hydrogen and helium-3, or deuterium and tritium, hydrogen with two protons. But light elements, and like what Matt was talking about, when you put positively charged particles together, they tend to repel each other. But if you can get enough force to squeeze them together and get them close enough, then the power that holds them together takes over, and what gets released is a huge amount of energy. And the way the H-bomb works is they use a regular fission bomb to provide the power to compress the hydrogen isotopes to the point where they fuse, and then you get this huge explosion. So the point is to be able to get that going on a very small scale. There are two approaches that have been worked on, and you're right, they've been working on that since the 1960s. And I remember when I first joined the LaRouche movement in 1973, one of the things that recruited me was LaRouche had a pamphlet out in which he talked about the need to get thermonuclear fusion, controlled fusion, by 1975-76. Mm-hmm. And one of my first deployments as a 20-year-old organizer was to go around to fusion scientists in the Washington, D.C. area and talk about this prospect. And while only a few of them thought we could do it by 1976 or 77, all of them thought we could do it by 1982 or 83. I mean, I would say 2 to 5 years, and the skeptics would say 10 years. Now, the reason why it's taken so long is what they were thinking about, and what I was thinking about at the time, and LaRouche was thinking about, was a crash program for fusion like the Manhattan Project. But what there are basically two approaches. One is to take the hydrogen and heat it up to the temperatures of the sun, and then contain it in a magnetic bottle. And that's called plasma fusion. And the other is what the breakthrough you're referring to, which happened at Lawrence Livermore National Labs. We had a couple of videos on the LaRouche site, and also if you go to the Lawrence Livermore National Labs site, they have some really nice videos up which describe how this works. But the way they're talking about it is you take a very tiny pellet, it's about the size of a human hair, filled with hydrogen fuel in a gold sphere, and you basically bombard this with very precise lasers from all directions so that you compress it so fast and so symmetrically that the you overcome these repulsive forces and get it to fuse. Now, what they achieved, they didn't achieve more energy out than in this experiment a couple weeks ago. But they did achieve ignition. They did get some fusion to take place. And so now they're doing more experiments and ramping it up. And had we had a crash program back in the 1980s, we could have had fusion by now. I think if we have a crash program now, we could get fusion in a very short period of time.
Hey, Bruce?
Yeah.
In regards to fusion, I was hoping that, well, I'm sure you know something about this, but that process known as sonoluminescence,
mm-hmm.
where you take sound frequencies and bombard them into a vat of water of some sort, and you start getting little bubbles that compress. Is that
light.
That produce light, yeah. I saw this little video on YouTube, and I was wondering if they speculated that there was a fusion process occurring in there. And
that's one hypothesis, yeah.
Okay, but
we
don't know that.
But
huh?
It's just a hypothesis. There's also, I didn't mention it, but the other thing is cold fusion. And there's also a lot of evidence that something's going on there that's quite interesting that we don't understand. So, yes, there's speculation and hypotheses, but it's not understood.
Can you describe cold fusion quickly, please?
Well, cold fusion is a phenomenon that was was known for a while, but it's somewhat relatively simple. It's sort of like electrolysis of water. But instead of using a copper or aluminum electrode, you use palladium and platinum, which have a very strong capacity, great capacity for absorbing hydrogen. And by having the right amount of deuterium in the water and having using palladium and platinum electrodes, you're able to force a huge amount of hydrogen into the metal. And the speculation is that this is some of this hydrogen is actually fusing. But that's just speculation. I don't think anybody has really figured it out yet. But it doesn't require the enormous power sources that laser fusion or plasma fusion, magnetic confinement fusion involves. So if it turns out to be a fusion process, this would hold great promise for being able to produce energy from fusion, useful power from fusion. But this was announced like in 1988, then it promptly got really denounced by the scientific community, by Nature magazine and the British and everything else. A real political pogrom was run against the scientists who were proponents of it. But the Japanese and, you know, some people in the United States and some people other places have continued to really do a lot of research on it, and it seems to be bearing fruit. I think I have time for one more question, if there is one. Otherwise, I have to go. But I can take one more question if there is one.
Anybody for your last question? Coming to you.
Bruce, I'm working with some kids in high school, many of whom are very bored with the subjects, and I'm just wondering about a way of exciting them in the way that that people who come to this movement tend to become excited. If you're talking about introducing some of these basic ideas at a younger age, where would you suggest beginning?
Well, you could do that, but the biggest problem you have in introducing this in that kind of setting is that the culture is so bad that you're sort of working uphill. And, you know, you can try and introduce these kids to some of these ideas. And the problem is that they're so influenced by this lost culture and society that it's very, very difficult to get their attention. All I can suggest is that, I mean, it can be done. Obviously, if you had a complete shift in society, you would get, you know, young people don't want to be bored. Mm-hmm. So if you had a different society, you know, different cultural impetus, you would see that the young people would be very excited about these kinds of ideas. In the absence of that, you really just have to use your creativity. And I would, you know, I don't really have any formulas that work. I think you just have to use your creativity and look for ways to flank these kids, but realize that that's what you're dealing with and that's the problem here. Although if you try and introduce things which people should be interested in, it's not going to work in this kind of culture. It will work if you change the culture. But there are things you can do if you establish a rapport with the young people and they realize that you are an opponent of the culture which they're having to accommodate to. Sometimes you can gain their trust. And if you can gain their trust, then you can introduce these ideas. You can't do it until you gain their trust. In order to gain their trust, you have to be straight with them that the culture that they're accommodating to is a bad one and you're opposed to it. And the problem is it's almost impossible to do that in an educational, a formal educational setting because the administration will fire you right away if you do that.
That's one way out.
That's true. I mean, you know, there are creative people out there and teachers who somehow seem to be able to inspire people and introduce them to great ideas, even within this system, but it really can't be done. That's why LaRouche has really stressed the development of an internal educational program within the youth movement.
Mm-hmm. No, and I appreciate that. Assuming that you could gain the attention of some of these people, especially the younger ones. I'm thinking, you know, quite young. If you were to imagine a healthy education system, maybe that's a better question. Assuming that we're able to win the battle, the war, and obviously the education system will change. It has to. What will it look like for the younger children? Maybe elementary to high school level.
Well, you would be introducing kids beginning at elementary level to basic making discovery. First of all, education would primarily be self-educated, self-guided. The purpose that you would want to have very small classrooms in that respect would be 5-10 kids per teacher. Hmm. Main goal of the role of the teacher would be to try and just guide the students towards things that they could discover for themselves. And you could do all kinds of interesting things, you know, with basically giving the children, guiding them through a process of self-discovery of all the great discoveries of science and culture throughout history. You would put a heavy emphasis on languages, learning many languages. You would put a heavy emphasis on art, especially music, but also other artistic art. You would put a heavy emphasis on experimental discovery of science, scientific programs, those kinds of things. And on study of history, so that children, when they graduate, would actually have discovered the whole richness of human development over the last 5, 6, 10,000 years for themselves. But it has to be self-guided. What people are excited about, things they discover themselves. They're not excited about things you teach them. Mm-hmm. You want to get kids excited, you got to give them a chance to discover something for themselves. So I gotta run. I still got things to do here.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce.
See you. Bye-bye.
Cool. Oops.
Why isn't everyone joining?